Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Spoken Heard. I'm Susan W. Chase, and today I am absolutely thrilled to bring you up for the second time a man with all sorts of wisdom and a man with all sorts of wonderful work, Mr. Abdul Kenyatta. How are you, sir?
Oh, I am blessed. I'm just truly blessed. Blessed with a brand new great-grandson yesterday and blessed with two beautiful grand nieces. So, I mean, I'm blessed beyond words.
I think it's amazing that in your family that you had three births yesterday. Absolutely amazing.
Well, you know, I've got 11 grandchildren, and now I have two great-grandchildren. So birthdays are always happening. You know, somebody's birthday.
Yes, but, indeed.
Yeah, I just got back from North Carolina the other day. I was at the Maya Kenyatta's fifth birthday party, you know, and, mm-hmm. and they had all the inflatable stuff, and they're bouncing around 200 kids and whatnot. I was like, wow, you know, I mean, it has been several decades since I have been around this many young people running and jumping and playing, and, you know, it was a bit frightening.
Why is that?
I'm just, I'm an old guy now, you know, I walk with a cane. And I used to be an elementary school teacher in the Virgin Islands, you know, and so we have hundreds of kids running around me all the time. But, I mean, I was 20, 21 years old, you know, I mean, it's like,
run around,
you know, bump into me if you want to, it's okay. But now, you know, I'm like in a whole different world. I'm like, I better tread a little gently over here.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. And again, congratulations for three births in one day. What an amazing, amazing day.
Yeah. That works out pretty well for us.
Mm-hmm. So I was wondering, Mr. Kenyatta, if I could ask you to read us a piece. I am so looking forward to hearing what you have with you today, and I'm so looking forward to our discussions. So could you do that for me?
I could definitely do that. I didn't know you wanted me to read today. I thought we were going to just talk.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
But no, that's okay. I do not have a problem. It's a piece called The River Nile. I am a member of the Society of Hearers, Seers, Thinkers, Rememberers, Recorders, Teachers, and Healers. I am on a mission commissioned by my ancestors 4 million years ago. I am called by them to connect the uncountable seasons of our flowing with our numerous unknown tomorrows. I am called by them to link genetic memory with Genesis, identity, and eternity. And in the interest of the legacy of continuity, I am called by them to communicate truth, complete, unexpurgated, and in detail. In the beginning, before time, there was the mother, father, creator. Then came the fire beneath countless eons, melting, glowing, churning, forming. Then the clouded atmosphere spat, then sprinkled forth moisture, building to torrents of rain, converging slime and water and more eons. And then on the shores of Mother Africa came the first human thing, and time developed people and mankind was born. The River Nile stretched her fingers into morning quietness and produced the children of the Nile, produced humankind in the first implementation of biorhythmic reality. The River Nile flows through my subconscious mind, and the reality is all over me, inside me, and through me. Across the gulf of time, I flow. I am the first child in a family of many. I was born hundreds of thousands of generations ago. I sit beside the river of legend, winding through thousands of centuries of history, streaming visions of ancient ancestors, conversating with my consciousness over a feast of beans to an unleavened bread, intoxicating my senses, producing visions recalling the ancient kingdom of Kush, visions recalling my warrior skills crossing the white sands, climbing hills, overlooking cities filled with people loving themselves, respecting one another, and taking care of business. Visions of the fabled mountains of the moon and the Kagera River. Visions of the pyramids of Nuri smoothed by centuries of sandstorms. I flow through the histories of humankind and drink the knowledge of eternal life and spiritual magnificence. I flow through the past, arm in arm with ancient ancestors, cautioning me not to repeat past mistakes, sharing secrets and encouraging me to continue the struggle, teaching lessons and dropping knowledge. I sit beside the river of legend winding through thousands of centuries of history, the River Nile, mother of all agriculture, propagator of all life forms. The River Nile, the mother of all rivers, flows forever in my unconscious mind. The River Nile flows forever and ever and ever and ever. The River Nile flows forever.
Mm. Bravo. I love how your work is oftentimes half storytelling and half poetry. I think that you do an excellent job of balancing your talent for writing poetry and your talent for telling stories. Is that how it's always been for you, or are you kind of a narrative poet who adds in significance? I love how you do that.
I don't really know how to explain it, how to break it down. I just do what I do, and, you know, sometimes I'll break into a song in the middle of a piece. I do what feels most comfortable for me to do. So it's kind of inexplainable. I work real hard on my craft, but when I get on the stage, 9 times out of 10, I don't know what I'm going to say before I start speaking.
Wow. That's amazing, too. So many people would be so nervous about going about it that way, but you feel completely comfortable in that, and that's what you would prefer to do, which I think is both unusual and kind of beautiful, because that you can read the audience like that. Did that come with time, or have you always, even when you were very young and first starting out, approached things that way?
You know, I grew up in Harlem. And I was mm-hmm. really fortunate. Grandfather, you know, who knew Harlem and knew it well. And he used to take me to Count Basie's club. And I would go to Count Basie's club, and, you know, at that time you had to be 18 in order to drink. And by the time I was 14, I could kind of get in when I would go in with him, and no one really questioned it because I was with my grandfather.
Right.
And so I would see Sammy Davis Jr. come in, you know, and he'd kick it around for a while, and then he'd jump on the stage and he would do something. He might play the drums. He might sing, you know. He might get off the stage and Pearl Bailey would come in, you know. She would say, she would talk, she would walk around with, you know, people, you know. Duke Ellington would be there, you know, Count Basie would be there. So, you know, I mean, I would watch these people, I watch them perform, and it just seemed to me that that's a natural thing that you do. You know, I mean, that's something that you do. I felt it. So I perform, you know. I mean, I do it all the time. I do it with my grandchildren. I'm always reading stories to them or telling them stories. I make up stories. I write stories for my grandchildren that I include their names in the stories and that kind of thing. You know, I'm kind of the old style Energizer Bunny. I just keep going and going and going, and I don't know what I'm going to do next, but, you know, I'm trying to get as much of it done as I possibly can. And I think that one of the things that is most exciting and interesting for me now is that I've been doing storytelling on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been a lot of slam poetry in the past and a lot of poetry, but I've never actually thought about getting up on the stage and telling a story. And then I realized that a lot of poems were actually stories that I was telling.
Absolutely.
So there was this new genre that was like saying, oh, come on, try this, you know. And so I've started doing that. And I've been on NPR a couple of times, you know, and I've been in a couple of shows. Jamie Kitty has a show in Oakland, and I've appeared there. And it's been a lot of fun. But actually it's an old tradition, storytelling, you know, that goes back in the African-American history. And so this young man who is the executive director of the San Francisco African Arts Culture Center came up to me and asked me if I would do help produce a poetry, a storytelling show.
Nice.
And I was, yeah, I would love to. I mean, but I guess for me, the part that's really great about it is that the executive director, his name is Muhammad Bilal. I've known him since he was a child. You know, he's been in programs that I've been a part of, and you know, I took him on trips with the NAACP to promote his talent and that kind of stuff. When I had youth programs, he was in those programs. When he became old enough, he became a counselor in my youth programs. So come and ask me to participate in the here and now, what's happening at his center, I'm just overjoyed.
Yes, yes.
You know,
that long-standing bond. Yeah.
So my best
friend,
Meg, we had been working on putting together a two-man show of doing our stories anyhow. You know, we call it Half Stories, Will Travel. So Mac is working on shows in New Orleans now, and I'm working on doing some stuff here in the Bay Area.
So you're going to do an extended run in San Francisco and New Orleans?
Yes, I'm thinking that we might want to do an extended run in San Francisco and in New Orleans. But I know that Mac really, really wants to tour. So I'm definitely going to be doing also.
Do you have any idea when you'll be available for booking or when you'll begin your extended tour?
I'm looking at early 2017. I really want to see if we can get the storytelling workshop started at the African American Center. We actually go out on the road and start doing other things.
And
so
what you're
like
doing
to,
at the... Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I'd like to get that set before we start moving around and jumping to different places and doing different things.
Absolutely. I think that that's wise. And I think, too, that, you know, you gentlemen are both so incredibly talented. And, again, we're talking about Mr. Mac Dennis as well. I just see this being an incredible, incredible hour or two of sitting back and listening to what you have to say. Is that the length that you're looking at? Are you looking at a full-length, like, theatrical piece, or are you looking at something shorter?
I think we're going to have to look at, we put it together, and it shouldn't, initially, I don't think it should be more than half an hour, but I don't see why it couldn't actually be a 90-minute piece.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
so
but it takes a lot of, you know, timing, rehearsal. You know, with me, you know, I'm like, oh, yeah, and I want to have a band, you know, and I want to sing. So, you know, I mean, it's like, you know, and Mac is like, well, I want to do some of the poems, too. And I'm like, yeah, we're going to do it all. So we got to sit down and figure out exactly what it is that we're going to do and develop a, you know, we've got a 20-minute show that we do. You know, that is just casual, just kind of knock it out. It's, you know, easy. But now we need to really hone a show and put it together and develop it. You know, both Mac and I have had associations with the Black Panthers, with the Black Student Unions, with the Civil Rights Movement. You know, I've been a country school teacher in the Caribbean. You know, I've traveled to Africa, met different people in different places and that kind of thing. So, you know, Mac grew up chopping cotton in Louisiana, that kind of stuff. We have an extensive history. I mean, I was really fortunate. I didn't recognize it at the time, but, you know, by the time I was 10 years old was when I met Malcolm X. You know, and so I used to get an opportunity to speak to Malcolm X on a regular basis from the time I was 10 years old till about the time I was 14 years old.
Oh, okay. So I have to ask you about that. How did that come about, and what did you learn from him? And what an amazing, amazing opportunity for you.
Well, I mean, all right. Malcolm X used to speak on the corner of 116th Street and Lenox Avenue, which is now Malcolm X Boulevard. And he used to speak at 125th Street and Lenox Avenue. And he used to speak at 125th Street and 7th Avenue, which is now Frederick Douglass Boulevard. So you could pretty much catch Malcolm on a regular basis making speeches at one of those locations.
Wow.
Each of those locations was by a subway station, so people would be pouring out of the subway stations, and a lot of times they would just hear the sound of his voice and stop and listen.
Yeah.
But I lived on Lenox Avenue, Malcolm X Boulevard, and in order for him to get from 125th Street and Lenox Avenue to 116th Street and Lenox Avenue where the mosque was, they had to walk down my block.
Mm-hmm.
So you see Malcolm coming down the block, and he would be with anywhere from 6 to 12 Nation of Islam brothers walking with him. All of them would have the Malcolm X speaks under their arms, and they're selling newspapers to the people as they walk down the street. But you could see they were all keeping their eyes on Malcolm.
Yes.
And he would stop, you know, and he would speak to people, you know, and adults and kids, but he always took time to talk to the kids. He introduced us to Cassius Clay, you know, I mean, it's
wow.
like nobody knew who Cassius Clay was, but, you know, Malcolm took time out to, you know, say, this guy, Cassius Clay, he's the Olympic champion, you know, and he's going to become world heavyweight champion. That was a big deal to us, you know. But, you know, Malcolm X was just a regular guy. He was a big deal to us. You know, it's like if you went into the Muslim restaurant and he was sitting there having a cup of coffee, more likely than not, he would call you over to sit at his table, you know, and chat with you. So, I mean, that's how we knew him. And, of course, we were attracted to him because he was kind of bombastic, you know, and he hated white people. You know, and so there was all of these reasons that, you know, to be able to buy into hating white people, you know, and so that you know, that was kind of cool. But then Malcolm went to Mecca. And when he came back from Mecca, all of a sudden Malcolm wasn't fighting for black rights anymore. He wasn't fighting for civil rights anymore. He had a vision, a recognition of the fact that it was about human rights. It's about the human race. So he came back dedicated to fighting for human rights, for all people, not just for black people. And then it made sense to him what he was doing. You know, and once it made sense to him what he was doing, he tried to share that with the rest of us. And that's what he was doing at the Audubon Ballroom the night when he got murdered, you know.
Yeah.
And that was the first time I ever missed one of his Audubon Ballroom meetings. And so I didn't go that night. You know, and so when I heard that he was assassinated, I was, like, shattered. I was like, I couldn't believe it.
Right.
You know, yeah.
Yeah.
One of those
yeah.
things, you know. It's one of those things.
Right. I'm sure that was a complete shock. Well, maybe not. I mean, had he stirred up enough press and enough, I guess, reverse prejudice,
It wasn't a shock. I mean, he talked about the fact that he was going to be assassinated. He knew he was going to be assassinated. I mean, people had already tried to assassinate him before. They'd come to his home before, you know, they shot through his windows and that kind of thing. So, I mean, not only did he know he was going to be murdered, he knew who he was going to be murdered by, you know.
Uh-huh.
And F knew who he was going to be murdered by also, you know. It's a thing. I mean, it's like, you know, one of the ways I knew Malcolm is that I was the president of a gang also. And, you know, talked to the gang leaders and stuff. And the deal is the Nation of Islam is like a gang. You know, I mean, you can't join the gang and then drop out of the gang and start your own gang.
Right.
I mean, that act of a traitor. I mean, why would you betray your gang and start another gang? You know, plus you're going to take guys from our gang with your gang. Wait a minute, hold on. That's not how we do stuff. Yeah, so if you leave a gang, I mean, you already know that people are out to get you. You know what I mean? So, yeah, he knew it was coming. It wasn't a surprise.
And to know that you spoke to him when you were just 10 years old and in those formative years, what an incredible, incredible story that is unto itself. So have you ever really ventured into telling that story on stage?
No, actually, I haven't told any of the Malcolm X stories on the stage. I told, like, stories about getting arrested with five white dudes, you know, and the first thing they did was they separated us. You know, they put me in one room and they put the white dudes in another room, you know. And so I call that the story about prejudice and discrimination and injustice. But, you know, and so, you know, and I tell a story about old sister groups who were sailing down and letting old Brer Fox reach out and catch her by the neck and said he was going to break her neck and pick her bones. And she shrieked so loud, she said, no, we're going to call the police here, you know. And the police came, and they were foxes, and they said, you should break her neck and pick her bones. And she shrieked real loud, and she said, no, we're going to take this man to the courthouse. So they went to the courthouse and got there, and the fox, the judge, he was a fox, too, and the jury, they was foxes, too. So they broke her neck and picked her bones, so you know that you can't get goose justice in a fox court. And so but what I didn't mention was that, well, first of all, the five white dudes, after we got busted, they didn't have anything else to do with me again, ever again. They never even talked to me again.
Right.
But I was like, oh, wow, I mean, what's up? So I'm thinking, you know, they're probably getting together. They're getting ready to sell me out is what I'm thinking. And
yeah.
So we get to the courthouse, and these guys got, like, Brooks Brothers lawyers with the suits and the ties on and stuff. Lawyer is like 5 minutes late. I got a court appointed lawyer. He's like 5 minutes late. I'm sweating bullets. He's 10 minutes late. I'm like, get out of here. He's 15 minutes late. I already know I'm going to prison for 5 to 10 years. And then my lawyer walks through the courthouse. Now, what I neglected to say to you in this situation, we were in the Caribbean. And my lawyer, he looked like me. And the judge, he looked like me. And my lawyer says to the judge, good morning. And the judge says to my lawyer, good morning, Judge Christian. My court-appointed attorney is a judge.
Wow.
Okay, and I'm like, yeah, okay. And I don't realize that the reason that most of the people are in the courtroom is because they want to hear Judge Christian do his thing. Okay, and so my attorney says, begging your honor's pardon, the reason that I'm late is that I was just outside in talking with the police officers before the case, and they said that they would like me to come in and to release all charges against my client without discrimination. So they released all the charges against me, and I walked out the door. And the reason why I say that this is a story of injustice and inequality is because the five white dudes got busted. They had to pay heavy fines, and they were expelled from the island and told if they ever came back again, they'd be sent to prison.
Wow. What an incredible story.
And feel what white privilege was like.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you grow up in the Virgin Islands, or how did it come to be that you were there? Was it fairly long term?
Well, okay, that it's kind of a long story. You know, what happened was that Stokely Carmichael had a meeting on 125th Street and 7th Avenue, which is now Frederick Douglass Boulevard, at the Michaud Bookstore. And he called together all the black student union leadership. And he said to us, they got this thing called COINTELPRO, and all of our organizations have been infiltrated. And they're going to bust all of us. They're going to get us on fake charges, false charges. They're going to murder us. The best thing that you could possibly do is to get out of the country. And then, like, Stokely Carmichael disappeared, and he went to, like, Africa, and H. Rap Brown went to Africa, and other people were getting killed or put in prison, you know. So I left. He said that we should leave, and so I left. And eventually, I became an elementary school teacher in the Virgin Islands, and I started a theater company there.
Wow.
But,
wow,
you know, I mean,
amazing.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's just, you know, you have to do what you have to do. You have to go where you have to go, but you don't have to change who you are. You have to keep doing the things that you know you're supposed to do.
Right, right. This is after your involvement in the Black Panthers or before?
This is after. I mean, actually, it was, okay, when we were in the Black Student Union, Stokely Carmichael became the prime minister of the Black Panther Party. Stokely became the prime minister of the Black Panther Party, then the East Coast Black Student Unions became part of the Black Panther Party. We gave our allegiance to Stokely Carmichael and the Black Panther Party.
Mm-hmm.
And Stokely told us that it was time to break. You know, we realized we had to break. You know, it's like you have to figure out, you know, where can I go? You know, what can I do? Who do I know? You know, what you know. It's, and fortunately, my family is from Trinidad, you know, so when I got to the Caribbean, people were able to recognize as I walked down the street that my family was from Trinidad. They would just say, so yours are Trini. Okay, now I'm Trini. You know, I'm like, okay, that's who I am. That's, you know, who I grew up in Harlem being, because in Harlem, where the area I grew up in, between 118th Street, 116th Street, about 114th and 125th Street, had a lot of West Indians. And, so each crew of West Indians had their own separate identity.
Yeah.
And technically, we didn't intermingle, but we did. So, like, when I was growing up, I brought this girlfriend home, and she was Jamaican, you know, and we're from Trinidad. But since she went to the same Catholic school that I went to,
she was
kind of acceptable. And then when she got to the house and my mother, I have five sisters, and so my mother spent a lot of time braiding my sister's hair. And the first time that this young came to my house, she sat down with my mother and started braiding my sister's hair.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, so, like, she was in like Flynn. You know, she was a member of the family. Was like, yep, she's one of us. You know, now, other girls wouldn't really know how to do that. I mean, I think it's kind of like a West Indian thing. She felt my mother felt her. I mean, they didn't have a conversation. She just started doing hair. And then, you know, almost by the time she came by the house, she would help my mother out and she would do hair. You know, she didn't have any sisters. So, you know, she enjoyed helping take care of my sisters. In fact, when we went to the movies on Sundays, I would bring all five of my sisters with us. So most of our dates consisted of me and my five sisters.
Wow. What an incredible, incredible story that is, too. We're coming up to the very end of the show. I can't believe how fast things go when I'm talking to you. There's just so much to say. And I wanted to point out, too, before the end of the show, that there may be an appearance or two on NPR coming up for you.
Yes, I'm hoping.
You're hoping. You've submitted some stories, haven't you? And you just are going to wait and see how that works out. And I know you've been on there before, so I'm just wishing you all the best of luck. The bigger platform you can have, the better. So you are just an amazing man with amazing stories, and I'm so glad that you share them with us. Unfortunately, I'm going to have to cut this right about now and say that my guest next week is Irene Bradley. And this is Spoken Heard. I'm Susan Dobie Chase. My guest today is the irreproachable Mr. Abdul Kenyatta. I hope to hear from you again, sir. You are just an amazing human being. And again, I thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Be blessed and continue to be the blessing you are.
Thank you. And you too, sir. This is Spoken Heard. I'm Susan Dobie Chase. Until next week. Be kind to one another.